Joseph Germano, born June 19, 1925. He served in World War II in the Marine Corps. His highest rank is corporal. This interview is taking place on May 29, 2013 in Mamaroneck, New York. This interview is being conducted by Jesse Kling with the assistance of Jan Northrup. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project of the Library of Congress. Okay, so firstly, could you just talk a little bit about your parents' backgrounds?
My parents were both born in Italy, and they were married before the turn of the century. And my father came to the United States alone and took a job in White Plains, New York, on an estate called the McCabe Estate. That's directly across the street from St. Agnes Hospital in White Plains. This estate was sold to General Foods later on in years, and it became General Foods' headquarters worldwide. But getting back to my father, he was kind of on an order of a caretaker, and he worked very hard at Mr. McCabe's estate, taking care of horses, cows, chickens, farming, and what have you. When Mr. McCabe passed away, there was not a job left for my father, so my father in turn went back to Italy, got my mother, and brought her back to the United States, and they settled in Mamaroneck. The reason they settled in Mamaroneck, my mother's brother was building a home on Center Street, and for some reason he decided to leave the United States and located himself in France. And my father somehow had the money to purchase the house that was being built, and that's where I was born, in the house that he purchased. My father was a landscape gardener. In those days, you not only did landscaping in the winter months, you tended to furnaces for most of the people that lived in the area, and did chores like getting wood ready and planting a garden for them, and he worked very hard at it. Then came the Depression. I was born, of course, 10 years after I was born, but I was the sixth child, so I was what they called a spoiled brat. I got bicycles and you name it, things that my sisters and brother did not do. Want me to elaborate some more, or?
If you'd like to.
Well, that brings us up to now, that I was born and I attended Mamaroneck Avenue School in kindergarten at 5 years old, went through Mamaroneck Avenue School, and I enjoyed all the sports that Mamaroneck Avenue School had to offer, especially baseball, because baseball, we would play Central School, we would play Chatsworth Avenue School, and Murray Avenue School. And our fields in those days were not big, elaborate fields, and I enjoyed hitting home runs over Murray Avenue School's baseball diamond and what have you. Going on to Mamaroneck Junior High School, I still did not get into books, reading and writing, arithmetic. I still liked playing sports. At Mamaroneck High School, I played basketball, little guy like me, and football, which I did not play too often, and baseball that I started to play, but I got tapped on the shoulder by a school teacher that was the coach of the golf team. And he says, "Joe, do you want to play baseball or do you want to play golf?" I looked up at him. I said to him, "You mean I qualified for the golf team?" He says, "Yes." So Gene Warrington, who owns, at this time, Walter's Hot Dog Stand, was on the mound pitching to me. I was catching for Gene. I took off my mask, took off. I said, Gene, get someone else to catch. I'm going to play golf. And that's what I did for 4 years at Mamaroneck High School. And I must say that I caddied all those years, and I enjoyed caddying at Wingfoot Golf Club, that I met some great people. I was at Wingfoot Golf Club when they were having changing of the guard. And when I say changing of the guard, the pro that started in 1925 was going to retire, and Craig Wood, who was the new pro, came up to Wingfoot and gone into the pro shop with his golf bag on his shoulders and his shoes in his hand, and I happened to notice his shoes were all scuffed up. In the meantime, I was always shining shoes, helping the locker man, and I was also cleaning golf clubs in a pro shop. Craig Wood put his shoes down and to look over the new establishment he was coming into, the pro shop. I happened to pick up the shoes, went in the locker room, shined his shoes, and I could see him looking around for his shoes. And I said, Mr. Wood, you want these shoes? At about 10 years old, 11 years old. And he saw they were all shined. After Mr. Wood, Craig Wood became the pro at Wingfoot. I was what they called his shag boy. Every time he would give a lesson, I would carry the bag with all the golf balls, and I would listen to him giving his lesson at the same time as picking up all the balls, and that's what I think made me get into golf. Ask me a question now on all that stuff. I can elaborate whatever you want.
So you mentioned you are the sixth in your family?
Yes.
So how many siblings did you have total?
I had four sisters, one brother, and myself. That's six.
So you're the youngest. And so you were a high school student when the war started, right?
Yes.
And do you have other family members who served in the military?
My brother.
Also
in World War II. He was in the Army. He was in tank destroyers. He was one of the first to be drafted in Mamaroneck.
Was he in the European theater or the Pacific?
He was an instructor.
So he was in the U.S.?
Yes.
What was his name?
Carmelo.
Carmelo.
And Jan wanted to know, did you know Sam Panessa or Arthur Boettcher?
I went to school with both. Sam Panessa, very bright young man. I used to copy his homework. Went through Mamaroneck Avenue School, high school, and very quiet sort of a boy. And we lost him like that. He was one of the first to be killed in the area that we know. And Arthur Boettcher, lovely guy, who lived on Palmer Avenue. Sam Panessa lived on Madison Street.
Did you know any others from the community killed in the war?
Yes. I know most of the people that are on the Kemper Memorial. My neighbor, he already passed away, was Cameron, Bruce Cameron. I believe it was Bruce. His father and mother were school teachers at Mamaroneck High School. And they lived in Harbor Heights. When I purchased the home, I lived next door to the Cameras. They retired after a while and moved away. I met Roy Carruthers, who lived out on a point on Oriana, who was the navigator when MacArthur said, "I will return." We never hear of Roy Carruthers. And he brought the plane in when MacArthur left the Philippines. Just about maybe 8 or 10 years ago, I was approached by Albie Munter. Munter family was very big in town. And he said, "Joe, Roy Carruthers, his name isn't on that memorial out in front of the police station." I says, "I'll look into it." He says, "I've been trying to get him on that, and they say no. They say no, and the reason that one of the American Legion quartermasters or whatever he was, he felt that Roy Carruthers was not living in Mamaroneck. But we got around that. Before you know it, we had a nice ceremony. Roy Carruthers' name was on. His sister and brother-in-law attended the writing of his name on the memorial in front of the police station there. That's something I can really enjoy talking about. Thanks to Albie Munter, who played football on Mamaroneck High. But Albie happened to pass away maybe 8 or 10 months after he mentioned that to me.
What was it like to have all these fellow high school students killed in the war?
I never thought of it. It just took day to day. They passed away. It's too bad. I could have been with them or something on that order. I was lucky. And if you really think about them, let's say some times I had with Sam Panessa, Sammy Panessa, we'll call him, because he had a cousin by the name of Sam Panessa, who was a very prominent plumber in town. But Sammy, if I thought about him playing baseball, I would get choked up. I would, so thinking him, I would try not to. And also Arthur Becker was pretty smart. He was about twice my size. Arthur was a tall kid.
So where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was called into an assembly at Mamaroneck High School. We had a new principal by the name of Joseph McLean. He did not handle the General Assembly. We had a history teacher who was very prominent in town by the name of William Fulcher. And I can still see him there, big, heavy-set man. Tell us what to expect. And most of us will be gone from Mamaroneck. He broke it all down for us very nicely. And we were kind of prepared. So that was then I was here in 1942, and in May of 1943, my good friend, lifelong friend, Albert Eatry, we used to call him Babe Eatry, he and I gypped school in May, and we went down and joined the Marine Corps in New York City, our first train ride into town, and the recruiting officer said, "You'll get your orders in August." So, go back and graduate high school, which we did do, and our parents gave us a bus ticket. I think it cost about $35. You can take a Greyhound bus and use it for the whole month and travel the United States for $35. And we went to Washington, D.C., then we went to Jacksonville, Florida, where his brother was in the Marine Corps. He was in the Marine Aviation. And another fellow by the name of George Panessa, Sammy Panessa's cousin, who never came back to Mamaroneck. He somehow, in a flight training, was lost at sea, down in the Caribbean or somewhere. George was quite a guy. I can remember George very well. And we also had, when we were there in Jacksonville, Florida, visited with a fellow by the name of Joe Ricosi, who was an Army sergeant. He came a couple of days. From there, we went off to my good friend Bay Beatrice Ant's home in Louisville, Kentucky. She showed us around Louisville, and boom, telephone rang. One of my sisters called and said, my orders were in before we expected. And I said to Babe, I'm going to take the train back. I don't know where I got the money, but I happen to have money on me, and I wanted to get right back and look at my orders. He says, I'll come with you. His aunt said, I'll put together some fried chicken. We said, no, don't do it. But she did, and before we left the Louisville, Kentucky train station, the chicken was finished. And we got back. I went in about a week or two before Babe. My orders were in before him. The only time I met Babe in boot camp, accidentally at the rifle range. And he went off into Marine Aviation, and I went into Fleet Marine Force. And I was sent to Camp Lejeune. And by some reason, there was a lieutenant looking for Germano, and I was in mud up to my nose. And the sergeant said, that's him over there. Tell him to get his gear and come with me. So I grabbed my duffel bag of gear, and I'm all full of mud and what have you. And I said, Lieutenant, what are you looking for me for? He said, we need radio operators, and you seem to have qualified the aptitude test. And you're going to radio school. We need them very badly. I got lucky there because the group I was with was going to get shipped out, just like Sam Panessa over there, overseas, very young. So I went to radio school, and I stayed on as a high-speed radio, learned that. And as I mentioned before, 24 communication men, including officers, went up to commissionership at Brooklyn Navy Yard. And we went off to the Pacific with a 3-star admiral who was the commander of Amphibious Forces Pacific Fleet, Admiral Richmond Kelly Turner. And he, in turn, went after we had the operation of Iwo Jima with the commander there, General Holland Smith. We picked him up in Guam. And we went over there with a fleet of ships. It was like Broadway and 42nd Street. The Pacific Ocean was full of ships. When we got to Iwo, though, they still were having the battleships send over some bombs, but still those Japanese were embedded in Iwo. And before you know it, Holland Smith went ashore, and we went back to Saipan, and we picked up an army general by the name of Simon Buckner, who was the commander of Okinawa, and we went to Okinawa. Let me backtrack just a little on Iwo Jima. A young boy that lived across the street by the name of Hugh Gumpel, who graduated Mamaroneck High School in 1943. I never knew it until one morning I was doing calisthenics out on the deck with our 24 men. After I got through, I got a tap on the shoulder. He said, Joe, hear this sailor? I knew most of my life, Hugh Gumpel. He was aboard the El Dorado, boy from Mamaroneck, and he was a signalman. And Hugh saw the flag raising. He happened to be on watch, go up on Mount Suribachi. I can elaborate more on that if you want. But getting back to, we went to Okinawa with General Buckner and his, oh my God, lots and lots of vessels again. I don't know where we got all these vessels to go out there. And He took his staff ashore about 4 days later and set up his compound. And about 2 days after that, we heard a sniper shot General Buckner, dead as a doornail. We left Okinawa for Manila. We again had all these vessels and what have you assembling in Manila Bay, and as we knew, being communication, we were in the radio room and knew we were ready to hit the mainland of Japan. And all the communication came in about how it was going to be done and what have you. We got, then all of a sudden, our President Harry Truman signed an order that we were to drop the atomic bomb on Narragansett. I must tell you, the ship, a cruiser, the USS Indianapolis, brought the bomb over and got assembled. But that was the Indianapolis was supposed to take good care of the El Dorado because there was a lot of brass aboard the El Dorado. When I say a lot of brass, James Forrestal, who was at Iwo Jima, Secretary of the Navy, was aboard. Joe Rosenthal, who took the picture of the flag raising and became a very famous photographer for the Associated Press, was aboard, including numerous other reporters and what have you. When I said that the El Dorado would communicate from the shores, they did. All these reporters and broadcasters got their chance to report back to their main office and in turn let the people back in the States know what was going on. But anyway, the Japanese didn't know enough when that first atomic bomb. So Hiroshima got hit with the second one, and they knew enough. And we thought the El Dorado would be going up to sign the treaty, but our admiral, he got on the Missouri, and he went up, and his staff, we took back to Hawaii, and they got off the ship, and when we were going underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, my commanding officer of the 24 Marines was handing out what our next tour of duty would be. Most of my fellow Marines aboard the El Dorado were going to Camp Pendleton in California. I got lucky, and my orders read Philadelphia Navy Yard. How lucky I was there. So after furlough, I went to Philadelphia Navy Yard. Do you want to ask me anything?
Well, you talked about a lot.
Did you take notes, what you're going to ask me?
Well, I have
a lot. And I'll elaborate.
So I guess there's a lot that I'd like to know more about. So I guess going all the way back to when you enlisted, so why did you and your friend enlist in the first place, you think?
Because things were not going so good in the Allied forces in Europe and in the Pacific. In 43, we were not doing good at all. The war was not in our favor. And we thought we'd better hurry up and get into the action.
So you wanted to take action at that moment?
Yeah.
Do something about the war?
Right. We wanted to get involved. Graduating high school didn't mean that much to us, but it was great that the enlisting officer said to go back and finish, which we did.
And when you decided to join the Marines, what kind of activity did you think you would be doing with the Marines? Did you ever think you'd be involved in radio command?
Never, no. I was with Fleet Marine Force, and my friend Albert Edry, Babe, he signed up for Marine Aviation like his brother did. He was wanted to go into Marine Air Corps, which he did, though. He was lucky enough to do that.
So when they selected you for radio command, what did you think, what kinds of things did you do, like when you were at radio operator school and you were learning to I guess, operate radios and the kinds of stuff you did?
When the lieutenant dropped me off in front of the barracks, he says, "You're going to see a Corporal Goodfellow in there, and he's all ready for you." And the best thing that ever happened was a shower, a bunk. I was with the other group. I was in a tent, Tent City, they called it in Camp Lejeune in those days. And I took a shower and what have you. And funny thing, that Corporal Goodfellow was my drill instructor, my DI at Parris Island. And he happened to have some ribbons, and one of the ribbons had a star. And I thought, man, he's an old salt. So now I'm buddy-buddy with him. I finally asked him, "What's that star mean in that ribbon?" I was out of the continental limits of the United States. I said, "What do you mean by that?" "I was in Trinidad," he said, so I was able to get the star. And he, in turn, was one of 24 Marines that we went aboard the El Dorado.
So when were you assigned to the Navy Yard because they were about to commission the El Dorado?
No, the El Dorado was, I was off the El Dorado when I went to Philadelphia Navy
Yard. I mean the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Oh, yes, that was going to be our tour of duty.
So was that the reason you were there? Was in preparation to get on the El Dorado?
Yes, we went to Brooklyn Navy Yard to get on here. The El Dorado wasn't ready to be commissioned. We did guard duty. 4 hours on, 20 off, and I would give one of my fellow Marines a couple of bucks, and I would stay home maybe 2 or 3 days. It was such a nice... And I would take some of my fellow Marines back home for spaghetti, meatballs, and show them around my Maranac.
So what was that like? Because I suppose you were with all kinds of different people from around the country at the Navy Yard, right?
No, we kept to ourselves, really. We had our own quarters and...
Like the people who you... The friends who you took over to your house and...
Oh, they were from all over, yes.
I suppose they weren't familiar with that kind of stuff, right? Many of them?
Many of them, right. I've stayed close friends with three of them. Two of them. One of them just passed away in February. One before that passed away about 2 or 3 years ago. And I have one that's hanging in there, and he did very well with Ryder Truck Rentals. He was one of their big wheels, and he was living in Jacksonville, Florida. We would visit him, had a nice estate there, and the last I heard from him, not the last, he sold his... This is a story all in itself, if you want to hear it. Sold his estate to his son. And he went into an assisted living, him and his wife. And I just heard from him just last week. He owned a farm in... it'll come to me and I'll tell you. And about 4 or 5 years ago, one of his daughters retired from school teaching, she and her husband, Costa Rica, asked her father if she could live or buy the farm in Costa Rica. He says, "You can have it." And just last week, he called me from Costa Rica. He says, "Joe, I'm not in Jacksonville anymore. I'm going to stay here in Costa Rica." So he and his wife are in Costa Rica.
So when you were at the Navy Yard, were you doing, were you beginning to do like actual radio command stuff?
No.
Are you still training?
We were doing guard duty. Our training was over. I have a diary of what we did board ship. But once the ship got underway, we were really on a shakedown cruise. We made one stop in Norfolk for something or another, went through the Panama Canal, which was quite interesting. Got to the other side. They dropped the 24 Marines in San Diego for more amphibious training at Oceanside. That's where we were. And the ship went up to San Francisco, Mare Island, for really some big repairs that needed to be done, and some more sophisticated radio equipment. And the sailors went off on leave. They had a furlough up there, and we had to work out in Oceanside. When the ship was ready to go out, we caught the ship in San Francisco, just about lucky enough to get on in time. And that's when we went out to Hawaii. We got lucky, had 2 days of leave, and we went to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, which the Navy took over, and we had a ball. That's when we came back, and we saw 3 stars flying on our ship, and we asked the officer of the day, "What's the story?" We have the commander of the amphibious forces, Admiral Turner, aboard. Once more, we got lucky, or I got lucky, being aboard with him.
Just to clarify, when you say 24 Marines, that's the number of Marines.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So it was 24 individuals, including the officers.
Right.
And were you the only Marines on the El Dorado?
Yes, the only.
Yeah. The only ones?
Yes.
So did you get amphibious training?
Amphibious?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Did you think that you would be, like, involved in any kinds of amphibious missions?
We could be called upon, yes. We went ashore, but we carried a weapon, of course, but our job, sightseeing, so to speak.
But you were still prepared to
yes.
do an amphibious landing
yeah.
if needed. And so what did you do when you got after Hawaii and you boarded the El Dorado again, right?
Yes.
And then from there, you went to Saipan?
We went to Guam.
Oh,
and
Guam.
Picked up the Marine General, very famous man. They used to call him Howlin' Smith. He would bark all the time. He was a good general. And we picked up his group of Marines, which were hundreds of thousands, so to speak. My God. And we went off on February 19th, 1945, and made the landing on Iwo Jima. About February 21st, my friend Hugh Gumpel, Navy boy, sighted the flag raising, and he was on a bridge. He happened to mention to the officer the day before, you know it, there was a lot of brass up there, and James Forrestal said, "I think we ought to get a bigger flag up there, and let me have that one."
Yes, I'd heard that story. So the first flag was considered too small.
Yes.
But the famous photo is of the first flag?
Second.
Of the second flag.
Yeah, that
flag
was a big flag.
Okay.
There's a lot of talk about that.
So Hugh was actually seeing the smaller flag go up.
I've got an article I can show you later. He gave a few talks. Hugh was a very famous artist of our area.
Oh.
Mariner Artist Guild, I think he was president for a while. He went to a school on GI Bill, and he was a teacher at Purchase. And when he got out of service, he taught in the area, and then he decided to move to Maine. Hmm. He had a brother that was a doctor at Port Chester Hospital, Roy Gumpel, good guy. And he had another brother by name, I forget his name. good people in town.
When you were at, you were at Saipan though, right?
Yes.
So what did you see at Saipan?
I was at Saipan when it was already over. That was over. I went to Saipan to pick up Army General Simon Buckner.
And he was the one who was later killed.
Yeah.
And when you were at Iwo Jima, was that when the battle was going on?
Oh, yes. We invaded. That was the day. Yeah, D-Day. Yeah.
So what did you see?
I didn't see very much that day because I was working in the communication room.
So what were you doing in the communication room?
Copying messages.
Like what kinds of things?
Code groups. With a typewriter.
Want to elaborate? Like what kinds of... Like you're dealing with code?
Code. And then the officer, they would come by and pick up the messages. Then he could go into the decoding room. I forget what the machine is called. And went on to the brass.
What kinds of things were you messaging?
I don't know.
You're just doing
just
the code
group. And, oh, then, not at that time. After that, I got into plain language. I would be copying news articles. That was easy. But the code group's tough.
Did you ever listen to Japanese communications? Did you have the, were you able to decode those?
No, I didn't decode.
But somebody on the ship? Was able to, or?
No, that was, that was tough. Hmm. But they tried. Mm-hmm.
So how far was the El Dorado off of Iwo Jima?
A couple of miles.
So you could see the island from where you were? But did you see, like, combat going on, or you were in the command room the entire time?
Oh, no. When we took a break, of course, we would take binoculars to see what was going on.
And what did you see?
Objects moving. You know, the ships along the shoreline that were stopped dead. You know, that they got either stuck or bombarded. Things on that order. Just people moving around.
Was it, like, what were you thinking when you were looking at Iwo Jima? Like, could you really tell what was going on from that distance?
Oh, yes. I could be alongside General Smith, and he mumbled quite a bit. Like I say, he howled all the time. And he thought the Navy should have bombarded for 5 more days or something on that order, you know. And it was a tough going because they were entrenched. As you read about it anyway, you can. That I don't think I can elaborate too much on.
So. After that, after Iwo Jima, you went directly to Okinawa?
No, went to Saipan.
Oh, you went to Saipan after Iwo Jima.
Yeah, for the next operation. Picked up the General Buckner. And then after him, we went off to Manila Bay. When we were ready to... They were ready to clean up that act fast.
And that's where you were preparing for a possible invasion of Japan.
Yes.
When you were in Okinawa, did you see the kamikaze planes in action? Or did you ever see the kamikaze planes?
Oh, yes. They hit our ship. One hit our ship. Boom.
Boom. Oh.
Yeah. Actually, Okinawa, we walked ashore on our end. We walked ashore the first 7 days. Never had the... Fire a shot, so to speak. But after that, then it got crummy. And on the other side of the island.
So you really couldn't see any of that?
No.
Yeah. But you could see the kamikaze planes?
Yes. general quarters would sound. They were flopping all over.
So what was that like, being involved in having a threat of kamikazes?
Jesse, you say a prayer. Let's hope they don't come down on us. And when that one hit us, and our ship, I think we had maybe three that they fired down, that shot in the air. They credited our ship for three kamikazes. And the red symbol of the flag, they was painted on the bridge, three red dots.
So even though you were a communication ship, you had ample anti-aircraft firing.
Oh, yes, we had a lot.
Had a lot of defensive mechanisms. But you were never offensive. I mean, you were not bombing.
No. Our job was to direct what had to be done.
Mm-hmm. So how badly damaged was the El Dorado?
Wasn't damaged.
Wasn't that?
No.
But I assume the pilot was killed. The kamikaze pilot was dead.
I guess on a slightly different note, what kinds of friendships did you form during your military service?
Three friends. And I mentioned to you.
The ones before.
If you want me to elaborate on each one, I will tell you.
I guess you can elaborate on like what?
One fellow was, his name was Barry Jones, who lived in Alma, Georgia. Barry went on, after he got out of service, GI Bill, and became an attorney. Very popular in his town. In Alma. Barry died. We visited quite a bit. Barry not only had a home in Alma, he had a home on Amelia Island, belonged to a nice country club called the Plantation on Amelia Island. We went down and visited him often. This was taken in Manila Bay.
How fun.
Each of the guys' names, they're there in Manila Bay, and here they are.
Oh, wow.
This was when...
1992.
This was back in 45.
Wow.
June 14th, 1945. Now who's the little boy? Just a little kid on the street?
He must be an old man now today, huh?
That's right.
Yeah.
He probably remembers that moment well when he was hanging out with you guys.
Wow.
This is Barry Jones. I told you about him, right?
Yep.
John Ross came from Natick, Massachusetts. John got out of service, became a plumber, and he did fairly well. He not only had his home in Natick, but he had a nice cottage up in the Cape. This is the four of us. This is Kinsey Reeves, who decided to go live in Costa Rica. This is at Kinsey's estate. Funny thing, how I kept in touch with Kinsey, I always mentioned to him, anybody, Mamaroneck, New York, because I enjoyed Wingfoot Golf Club, and they all remember that.
Right.
Kinsey was going through Mamaroneck. His office was in New Jersey. Now he's with a trucking company. And he had a problem up in Massachusetts or somewhere. And he happened to see Mamaroneck, New York. He got off and asked, Joe Germano. Yeah, it's right down the street in that gas station down there.
Oh, no.
Like
how
that.
Fun.
And I took off and we had a very nice chat. And he told me what he was doing. And he had this problem with the union.
Wow.
And before you know it, tough guy, he had the union like this, and his trucks weren't bothered very much. Now, I got to tell you about him because one of his sons, he had a couple of daughters, but one of his sons got a swimming scholarship to University of Miami. About 2 months after he was down in Miami, he came home, his son. He says, what are you doing here? He says, Dad, I don't want to go to college. He says, you're not going to hang around here, you know. He says, no, I'm going to Alaska. His son got to be a multimillionaire in Alaska. Could you imagine? His father's ready to sell the place, his big estate in Jacksonville, Florida. The son said, I'll take it. I'll buy it from you.
Now, what does the ACG stand for? You have
AGC 11. Amphibious Group Command.
Oh.
That's the ship.
Amphibious Group Command.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we were just wondering, when you talked about like an aptitude test was how they decided that you were fit for doing radio communications.
Say this again.
You said that you took an aptitude test.
Yes. They give you an aptitude test. You know, dot, dot. See if you can distinguish the dot and the dash and stuff on that order.
Oh, this, the Morse code. Yeah. They were asking you how well you
did. I never knew that, you know. But I took like a ham course at Mamaroneck High School at lunchtime. It was a ham radio course.
So you're already familiar with that kind of stuff.
I took a commercial course at Mamaroneck High School. I wanted to be a male secretary and bodyguard, little guy. But that's a story in itself, how I got wanted to do that. And I took typing. So I already knew all that stuff. And somehow I got lucky and became a high-speed radio operator to go along with these guys on their venture.
So would you say before you enlisted you were already interested in radio?
Not really, no. Not
but
really.
It was just something you were familiar with?
Yeah. I got lucky to know, I guess.
So I guess you have maintained pretty good contact with the friends you made during the war, right? Your closest
yes.
friends.
Yes. The three of them. None of the others, but the three of us were really close. Barry Jones, he got to call me up. He was flying from Georgia. He was a pilot, had his own airplane. And somehow the weather was bad, and he landed up at Armagh, at the airport there. It wasn't elaborate the way it is today. It was like the old field, and he landed there. He picked up the phone, and my wife thought that somebody was pulling a joke on me, you know. He was Southern accent and what have you. And she said, Joe, somebody's here. I don't understand them. Before you know it, it was Barry. And my grandson, Michael, who was also at that time young, and he was flying an airplane at 17 with the CPA. Civil Air Patrol. He got into that at 14. And before you know it, he got his pilot's license. You come with me. So we went up, looked at his airplane, and Barry's wife, who was co-pilot, so to speak, showed my grandson what the instruments were and how they were flying. But they were grounded because of the weather. That's how I got to see him. And Johnny Ross, he was driving down to Florida from Massachusetts. He was going to retire. That's how I got to see John. And we got together.
And during the war, were you able to keep in contact with your family and friends back at home?
Yeah, by letter writing, yeah. Yeah. And, of course, they heard the El Dorado was giving communications, you know, broadcasting, and they would pick that up. They knew where I was and what I was doing.
Wow.
Then
so they could keep track of you, sort of. Yeah.
It wasn't often, but every once in a while.
Mm-hmm. How did you picture your own role in the war as a whole?
Say that again.
Like, how did you picture how, like, you mentioned that that one of the main reasons you enlisted was because the war was going badly for the Allies. So when you were in service, did you still, like, think that, like, you were playing a role in the whole war, that you were making a difference in the whole war? Did you think about that at all?
I didn't give that a thought. I just did what they told me to do and try to do it the best I could and let it go at that. I never gave that a thought, whether I was important, whether I wasn't important. I just had a job to do. I did it.
Did you feel your ship was important, though?
Well, that was
a very important ship. So that, yes, that was not just for having all the dignitaries, but also for doing all the communications.
Well, that too, but having all those dignitaries aboard was very important.
Now, did the Japanese know that the El Dorado had all
this? Oh, no. Well, if they knew, they would have got
it. I was going to say, then you would be just a target, right?
As I mentioned, the Indianapolis was our escort. We had other ships. We had submarines being our escort.
To make sure that you were
that,
safe.
That brass had to be safe. They were running They were running the show. How lucky I could be aboard that.
Then were you there when the Indianapolis was sunk, right?
Yeah, but that
was
it had gone on its own.
So you weren't, that didn't have to do with it.
That wasn't tied to us at that time.
So you were in Manila when the war ended?
Yes.
In Manila Bay.
1945, right.
What was your reaction to the end?
Thank God. Jeez. What are you kidding? There it is, June. And the treaty was in August, right? They signed the treaty.
Right.
Yeah.
You ended up going to the Philadelphia Navy Yard?
Yeah.
And how long were you there?
Until I was discharged.
In 1946? February,
yeah.
And when you were at the Philadelphia, were you able to see family and stuff like that?
Every day.
Wow.
That was another one. I would be 4 hours on, 20 off. And if I gave a guy a couple of bucks, not a couple at that time, about a $5 bill, I could stay a couple of days, he would take my watch.
So even though you were in Philadelphia, it still felt like you had come home.
Oh, yeah. I would eat meals at home. And I would come by train, get to Penn Station, and I would take a cab to go to Grand Central. Till I was with some guy. He says, where are you going? I says, I'm going to Grand Central. And he says, how are you getting there? I said, by cab. He says, follow the red lights. He says, I'll show you. And I was able to walk from the Penn Station to Grand Central. And it didn't cost me a dime. That's things that you remember. My God. Oof.
So when you did come to Philadelphia's Navy Yard, how were you received? And you saw your family again. How were you received by your family?
Oh, they were glad to see me. But then when I was discharged, they had in front of my house a welcome home, Joe.
So that was really when you were able to come home.
Yeah.
And how did the community receive you? The Mamaroneck community?
No big deal, because servicemen galore were coming in. It was like second nature. It's just, hi, where'd you go? How'd you do?
What was it like to readjust to civilian life?
I had no readjustment, Jesse. I was a 17, 18-year-old kid. Really didn't know my direction, what I was going to do. But I got lucky again. My neighbor, a fellow by the name of John Civitini, came over one evening I was eating while I was still in the service. He says, Joe, my mother wants to see you.